give people a few more minutes to be able to join here, and then we'll determine whether or not we have quorum to be able to proceed. So I have down 10 o'clock right now. Let's give everybody about another 2 minutes, and then we'll go ahead and resume.
Thank you for attending, everyone. We'll get started in just a few minutes. We want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to log on. As a reminder, please keep yourselves on mute until you're ready to speak.
Great. Well, Sandy, thank you so much for the reminders here and then to organize this meeting. I have down that it's 10:02 on Monday. I'm going to go ahead and start the meeting to be able to see if we have quorum, and we'll see what next steps would be appropriate. So good morning, everybody. My name is Frank Trou. I am the chair of the Washington State Cosmetology Hair Design, Barbering, Aesthetics, and Manicuring Advisory Board. It is now 10:02 on Monday, July 14th. And I'm calling this meeting to order. This meeting is open to the public. We take time at the end of the day for a brief public comment period. Participants will have up to 3 minutes to address the board. As a reminder, board members are not to engage in conversation during public comments. We're just here to be able to receive the information to listen. As a courtesy, I want to ask all participants to keep themselves on mute to reduce any background noise. I do see that we do have some board members that are here. Board members, if you would like to comment on a specific topic, if you can reach out to be able to hit that raise hand option at the top of your screen there, that will go ahead and allow us to track who's raised their hand in what order. Once we have called on you, please unmute yourself. State your name before sharing your comments for our records. Please remember to mute yourself again after you finish speaking. All right, so let's go ahead and let's start off. I'm going to go ahead and ask the program specialist, Sandy Bauer, to be able to do, to call for roll call to confirming people that are in attendance. So once your name has been called, please respond by stating here or also president. Ms. Bauer?
Thank you very much. I will start with you, Chair Trou.
I'm present.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Garcia?
Here.
Board Member Cooper Deaton?
Here and present.
Board Member Hildebrandt. Board Member Martin. Board Member Switalski. Board Member Thomas. Board Member Williams.
Oh, present.
And I see that Board Member Martin just arrived. So we have... We do not have a quorum yet.
Okay.
So this will be an information report out only meeting. We would need to skip to agenda item 5, which there are no awards or recognitions to discuss today. Yes. Deborah Allenbaugh.
I count five board members. Doesn't that make quorum out of?
We need six for
we
a quorum.
We need six. Okay. Thank you.
Correct. Yeah, we need six for a quorum. So, Chair, it's up to you. Would you like to proceed with an information-only report-out meeting?
Yeah, I think that that's probably best out of respect for the members of the public that have come joined us here. So, unfortunately, we are short by one board member. And I guess before we start moving with just a one-way meeting, right, for information, I think that maybe we can just go ahead and make our own internal notes that let's go ahead and follow up with board members that are not present. It's really unfortunate that we're in this position right here where the members of the public have given their time and they do expect the board. Yeah.
Chair, board member Hildebrand just logged in. So we do have a quorum.
All right. Much better. Okay. I think that
Board member Swatowski just logged in.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and we'll go ahead and then we will, therefore we do have a quorum. Thank you very much for all the board members that have been able to attend. I think your presence is really important for us to be able to do the business of the board here and know that you represent important roles and this is a really critical process in the regulatory process here. So we have a quorum. Then we will move on to agenda item number three. I'm going to go ahead and ask board members to refer to pages three, four, and five in their packet and where they can go ahead and take a look at the minutes to approve. So what I will do is
we need to approve the agenda first and then we'll move on to the minutes.
Perfect. All right. So let's go ahead and take a look at the agenda. I'd like to be able to entertain a motion to approve today's agenda as presented. I'm looking for somebody to make that motion. I see Vice Chair Garcia have her hand up. I'm assuming you're making that motion there.
Yes, I'd like to approve or make a motion to approve the agenda.
And I see Board Member Jenny have her hand up. I'm assuming that's the second.
Yes, sir, the second to approve the motion.
I have a first and a second. Are there any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Agenda is accepted. Let's go ahead and move on to agenda item number four, which is the approval of minutes. In your packet, you should have received the April 7th, 2025 minutes. That's on pages 6 through 11. Is there a motion to approve the April 7th, 2025 minutes as presented?
I approve.
Right. Could you state your name there, please? I didn't see the box light up.
Ayanna Thomas.
All right. So Board Member Thomas has made the motion. I see Board Member Janine have her hand up. I'm assuming that's the second.
I approve.
Okay. All right. So we have a first and a second. Are there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? All right. Those minutes have been accepted. As we move on to agenda item number five, that is for awards and recognition. There are no awards and recognitions to discuss today. Therefore, we're going to move on to agenda item number six under old business. Under 6.1, the agenda item is entitled the in-person meeting update. So we will go ahead and I will ask Ms. Bauer to give us an update regarding the in-person meeting for this upcoming year. Ms. Bauer?
Thank you, Chair True. As you may be aware of, back in December, Governor Inslee had a directive that implemented a spending freeze. It is still in effect. Due to the timelines that are required to plan for an in-person meeting, we will not be able to offer an in-person meeting for 2025. Additionally, we will not be able to plan for the NIC conference attendance either. Now, this does not preclude board members from attending on their own. We just won't be able to authorize travel for that. Are there any questions?
Well, thank you for the update, Ms. Bauer. I'm looking across the board here to see any hands up. I don't see any up, but I do want to acknowledge the importance of these meetings. I really was hoping that we could have an in-person meeting this year. I mean, we have 37 people that are on this call here, so there is definitely an interest, but we recognize the environment as it is. I do see Vice Chair Garcia have her hand up. Vice Chair Garcia?
Yes. I just wanted to add that NIC is currently working on some sort of digital viewing for speakers for the conference, because our state is not the only state that has a travel ban at this time. And so I can report to Sandy as I hear changes in that.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, great. Vice Chair. And I can share that out as you share it with me.
Excellent.
Yeah, you know, and I really appreciate Vice Chair Garcia for bringing that up. I mean, she's represented Washington State, my goodness, over the last 2 or 3 NIC meetings, and I think those have been really beneficial for us as a state here. All right. So with that, we'll go ahead and move on to new business. I don't see any other old business here. I know that we do have a guest that's here from the Department of Ecology. I'd like to be able to go ahead and ask Ms. Bauer to be able to introduce that representative. Ms. Bauer?
Thank you so much. We are really excited to invite Sherry Franjevic from the Department of Ecology to talk to you about the Toxic Free Cosmetics Act. This is a really impactful bill that has a lot to do with the industry, and I'm very excited to have Sherry come and talk to you about this. Take it away, Sherry.
Thank you so much, Sandy, and the board for inviting me to speak to you today. So again, my name is Sherry Franjevic, and I'm an environmental planner at the Department of Ecology, and we are the agency that's implementing the Toxic Free Cosmetic Act, and my role is to lead the implementation of this law. Next slide. I'm going to begin with an overview of the law and its requirements, and then talk about the rulemaking processes for formaldehyde and lead. And I'm hoping the presentation will take about 15 minutes, and I'm happy to answer questions at the end. Next slide. With that, I'm going to introduce Washington State's Toxic Free Cosmetic Act. Next slide. One more. There you go. The bill was signed into law in the spring of 2023, and it has 3 key elements. First, the law restricts 9 toxic chemicals and chemical classes from cosmetic products that are manufactured, distributed, sold, or used to provide a service in Washington State. Second, the law authorizes our agency, Ecology, to conduct rulemaking on 2 different things. One is to identify and restrict chemicals that release formaldehyde, and the second is to adopt a different regulatory strategy and or limit for lead impurities. Third, the law also directs Ecology to assist small businesses that make or use cosmetic products to transition to safer ingredients and products. One of the initiatives that we're developing in this third bin is for salons, and we'll start with hair salons and barbershops, and we'll provide technical support and financial reimbursement to participating businesses to purchase and use eligible safer products. So my talk today will be focused on items 1 and 2. But I'd be happy to share more information about our voluntary initiatives in future conversations. Next slide. The law defines a cosmetic the same way as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration does, which is anything intended to be used on the human body for the purposes of cleansing, beautifying, promoting attractiveness, or altering appearance. So cosmetic products are more than just makeup. It includes things like perfume, shampoo, hair gel, body wash, deodorant, hand lotion, toothpaste, shaving cream, sunscreen, just to name a few. So it's pretty much every beauty and personal care product. Next slide. So the law restricts 5 individual chemicals and 4 chemical classes. The chemicals that are restricted include formaldehyde, methylene glycol, triclosan, and 2 different phenylenediamine salts. The classes that are restricted include phthalates, PFAS, otherwise known as forever chemicals, mercury in its compounds, and lead in its compounds. Next slide. So beginning on January 1st of this year, 2025, the restrictions went into effect on these different 9 chemicals and chemical classes in Washington state. And these are all 4 chemicals when they are intentionally added into a cosmetic product. And in addition to that, lead is also restricted when intentionally added and when present as impurities or contaminants at a level of 1 part per million or above in the cosmetic product. We did issue an interim policy on that lead restriction on lead impurities that I'm going to talk about in a few more slides. There is a 1-year sell-through period for in-state retailers to exhaust their existing stock. So while the restrictions went into effect January 1st, 2025, there's a whole year to sell through any existing stock before those restrictions go into effect on existing stock. Next slide. So I'm going to provide a high-level overview of our compliance approach. We do anticipate having additional guidance later this year as we're staffing up our compliance team. Cosmetology businesses and cosmetologists are responsible to know about and comply with the law. And our priority as an agency is to help you know about the law, understand it, and comply with it. And we do that through outreach, education, and technical assistance. And in the case of potential violations, we focus first on education and clear communication before ever moving towards enforcement. There is a link on the bottom of this slide. You will be receiving the slides if you haven't already. And there is a link there to a webpage that has more information about compliance specifically for cosmetologists and cosmetology businesses. Next slide. I also, on this slide, we have a few more links to additional resources. The first is that webpage for cosmetologists. We also have a Q&A document about compliance with the law that's been published. The 3rd and 4th bullets there are 2 different publications that give more background information. They talk about what chemicals are restricted, why they're in cosmetic products in the first place, how they function, which products they're used in, and what kinds of harms that they cause to people in the environment. And then the final bullet has a link to that voluntary initiative that I was talking about a little earlier. That's the webpage that talks more about that. Next slide. All right, so now I'm going to talk about the 2 different rulemaking processes that we have underway to support this law. And while laws are written by the legislature, rules are written by the agency implementing the law. And rules typically clarify and sometimes expand on existing laws. And rulemaking is an open public process where you can engage and you have the potential to influence the outcome. Next slide. So the first rulemaking I'll talk about relates to formaldehyde and formaldehyde releasers. So examples of some products that use formaldehyde and formaldehyde releasers are chemical hair straighteners, nail polish, eyelash glue, but it's used across the board primarily as a preservative. So The law itself, passed by the legislature, already restricts formaldehyde and methylene glycol, and those restrictions went into effect January 1st of 2025. So we have this proposed rule that would restrict all other formaldehyde releasers, if adopted, starting on January 1st of 2027, with then a one-year sell-through period through the end of 2027. All right, next slide. So rulemaking processes typically take 1 to 3 years to complete. This one was on the shorter or faster side. We are nearing the end of the rulemaking process for the formaldehyde rule. There are no additional opportunities for public engagement and feedback. But this timeline, I wanted to go through it because it gives you an idea of the stages of the rulemaking process and where the engagement opportunities are. So in this case, we announced the rulemaking in May of 2024, so just a little over a year ago. Then last summer, we hosted some webinars with interested parties in June to talk about ideas for the draft rule requirements. Then in July, we shared our first cut at a rule, so it was called a preliminary draft rule, and we started taking informal comments. And we did that by both hosting webinars to take verbal comments and get discussion, as well as taking written informal comments. And then in the fall, we used that feedback to create our next draft, which we called the formal draft rule. And with that, we also conduct an economic impact analysis. Once we go through that process, we propose, meaning we publish that formal draft rule, and we put it out for formal comment. And that includes formal hearings where there's verbal testimony as well as taking written comments. Once we do that process, we collect all that information, and where we're at now is we're working on our response to all those comments and making the final revisions to that rule, which we'll present to our director, the director of our agency, by the end of August for potential adoption. Next slide. So just to give you an idea of formaldehyde releasers and their scope of use. So they're only currently used in about 6% of cosmetic products in the United States. And that use, those percentages have been declining over the last decade or more. And they can be used in all sorts of cosmetic products. The highest percentage of use or the most common uses are in hair products at 14%. Bath products at 12% and skincare products at 8%. And as I mentioned earlier, they're primarily used as preservatives, and there are many alternative preservatives currently in the market and products that are using other preservatives at various price points. Next slide. So formaldehyde is also used as a cross-linker to help smooth and straighten hair. There's some confusion here because there's a couple different categories of products that serve this function. Hair relaxers are one. Hair relaxers have never contained formaldehyde, don't contain any formaldehyde, will not contain formaldehyde. They use a different chemical strategy to straighten hair. So the products that have historically contained formaldehyde or formaldehyde releasers are often known as keratin treatments or the historical Brazilian blowout type products. They've contained primarily either formaldehyde or methylene glycol. In some cases, they have contained other formaldehyde releasing chemicals. We know that there are products on the market today that claim to be formaldehyde free. We also know that some of those products still contain formaldehyde releasing chemicals. So when you test them for formaldehyde, there is formaldehyde in those products. Right now, you know, we're looking into what the industry is moving towards in terms of alternatives, and there's work going on to identify what those alternatives are, what those products are, what chemicals they're using, and whether they are indeed safer. But we're not yet aware of what that looks like, but there's a lot of research going on in this area. Next slide. And the last thing I'll say on that is that manufacturers do have 2 years to innovate if this law is adopted. So we know that more formaldehyde-free alternatives will continue to be in the market. And we're already seeing movement in that direction. All right. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about lead impurities in cosmetics and our rulemaking in this area. So lead comes into cosmetic products from any ingredient that's mined from the earth. It will contain some amount of lead impurities. And the higher percentage of those mineral-based ingredients that go into a product, the higher level of lead impurities will be in that product. So the kinds of products where you see higher levels of lead impurities tend to be makeups that have a lot of mineral-based colorants, such as eyeshadow, blush, and foundation, as well as products that contain high concentrations of clay, such as clay masks. So the lead limit in the law is 1 part per million in cosmetic products. And what we learned at the tail end of last year before the restrictions went into effect from manufacturers is that there are certain products that just cannot consistently stay below that 1 part per million lead threshold. Next slide. So we took a couple of key actions before the law went into effect. We did issue an interim policy, and the policy provides manufacturers with alternate pathways for compliance. It basically gives them time to transition to these lower lead levels, and it gives us as an agency time to learn more about what the challenges are, what product categories are not able to reach it, and what a feasible lead level might be. So with the policy, manufacturers have to notify us that they're using the policy, and then they can meet these other alternate lead levels. And the intention of that policy is that it's a temporary solution while we create a more permanent solution, which is the rulemaking process. So we announced that rulemaking process to determine a feasible approach to regulate lead, which could potentially mean we change that lead limit from 1 part per million to something else. As I mentioned earlier, rulemaking usually takes 1 to 3 years to complete. We are in the very early stages of the rulemaking process in this case. So on the opposite end of the spectrum from the formaldehyde rule, where right now we're really gathering information to inform and develop a strategy for what that rule might be. We haven't even written a preliminary draft rule and don't imagine doing that until about middle of next year, so somewhere around June 2026. There will be several opportunities for public involvement and feedback, and we do really encourage you to get involved, and we anticipate the first opportunities for engagement will be later this calendar year. Next slide. Okay. And I just want to wrap up by telling you 2 key ways that you can get involved. The first is to sign up for email updates. We use that to announce everything from ways to get involved in rulemaking, to alert you to new resources, to remind you about important dates. And the second is to attend webinars that will be announced through those emails. And it's about all aspects of the law, including the voluntary initiatives, compliance support, as well as the rulemakings. All right, next slide. With that, I'd like to turn it back over to you, Sandy, to facilitate any questions.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming today. Do any board members have any questions for Sherry? Yes, Board Member Cooper Deaton.
Hello. I just wanted to say thank you so much. That was really informative and helped clarify some things for me. I really appreciated the resources page, and I will go back and look through some of those. But I wanted to ask if on that page or somewhere else you have specific skincare brands that, or products, or clay masks, for example, from brands? Or is that something that you're working on to gather a group of that?
Yeah, thank you so much. That's an excellent question. So we don't gather information per se on products that do or don't contain, I think you're referring to the lead rule. So the way that the law works is it applies to all products, but it's not in effect yet. So, I mean, we have the temporary policy that's in effect, but we don't gather lists of products. The expectation is that all products comply with the law. So you're, in theory, like every product that you get off the shelves should meet the requirements of the law. Since we do have this interim policy, what we do have is you can find on our webpage, and we can share more about that. I think we have it on the next slide. Yeah, maybe not, but I can share it afterwards as well. We have an interested party webpage, and there you can actually download the list of companies that have notified us of the use of the policy and then what option of the policy that they selected. And I didn't talk about the options, but it basically gives you a sense of where their lead levels are today. One of the options has them under 5 parts per million, and another option is between 5 and 10 parts per million. So depending on what option they select, you'll know where their lead levels are today. Again, all of that is within compliance with this interim policy. Once we adopt a rule or don't and go back to the statutory lead limit, everybody has to comply with whatever we come up with at that time. But right now, what they have to comply with is the policy.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And happy to answer more questions about the policy as well.
Board Member Martin.
Hi, and thank you for being here. I just wanted to, I guess, clarify that most of these things are going to be happening at the manufacturer level.
Absolutely. So our right. expectation is that the manufacturers ultimately reformulate, take these chemicals out of the products. And so by the time they get to the distributor, or the retailer, or the cosmetology business, they should be compliant with the law. So that is our expectation. And the primary area that we do our outreach is to manufacturers, and that's the primary area where we're providing technical support and really helping people understand their requirements. However, I will say, as you saw in the slide, everybody along the supply chain is responsible to know and comply with the law. So what that really looks like when you're on the end of the supply chain that you're on is confirming with your distributor, hey, is what you're selling to me compliant with this law? Yeah. And that's the level of your responsibility, really.
So, sure. And so to piggyback off that theory, ironically, in Spokane, when I went to several, supply houses in Spokane, and I spoke with basically managers in the stores, and I asked them, I just sent a tickler like, hey, are you guys aware of the toxic free, act that came out, that's happening, that's doing stuff? And they all said, what? No. What are you talking about? So then, of course, I took a moment to, you know, visit with them and share, you know, like, hey, go to this website, talk to your, you know, I don't know, your regional CEO, yep, managers, whoever you have to talk to, get them on board, because they didn't know. So with that being said, what I'm getting to is that if it's at the manufacturer level, and then it doesn't, in fact, still trickle down to the consumer that might have these potential still toxic products, but we're supposed to connect with our suppliers and they don't really know about it, then what is the move?
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you for doing that work. So the next step would be to have them contact us. If they don't know about it, just send them to us and we will work on that education and outreach. I will also say that we do have efforts Second half of this year, we're really focusing on trying to get the word out specifically to cosmetologists and cosmetology businesses, retailers, and distributors. We think we've done a really great job of letting manufacturers know about this law, and that's been our top priority early on over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years. Now we're really shifting our focus to make sure that everybody down the supply chain is aware of it. So anyone that doesn't know, send them to us. Happy to talk to them.
100%. Last part of my question is I do have several colleagues in the Spokane area and across the mountain that have just reached out and asked, like, oh, well, what does this mean? Are we supposed to just throw all of our stuff out? And I said, no, I said, hold on, don't do that. So what is the solution if any of them are listening today?
Yes.
Just contact you.
Thank you. So the solution is that you have until December 31st, 2025 to sell through your existing stock. So sell it, use it. Right now it's legal as long as it was in Washington state prior to January 1st of 2025. So if you have it and you had it before January 1st, 2025, use it. Once December 31st of 2025 comes around, that's where we're going to have to start talking about what to do with any existing stock. So right now, the message that we're trying to get out, which is why we're trying to do this outreach now, 6 months in advance or whatever, is to try and make sure that people understand that and are moving those products through.
Got you. I wish, I see other people have questions. I wish I had more time with you, but maybe I'll just email you
and
we can chat about it.
Happy to have conversations. Please reach out.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Chair True.
My question is that with this being enforced by the Department of Ecology versus the Department of Licensing, can you walk through, I'm sure it's in the documents and the links that you had shared, but could you just give this like high level overview, education, and then what does this enforcement look like? I mean, are you guys issuing fines? Are these actions going to be done through the Department of Licensing against people's licenses? What does that look like?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I will say that the law does give us the authority to fine people for violation, businesses and people for violations. However, as an agency, our philosophy is it's much better for us to help you get into compliance. It's better for the health of people and it's better for the health of the planet. So our goal is to get you into compliance. We're not interested in enforcement actions. We're going to focus on compliance first, and we're going to focus on helping you get into compliance through providing you with information, resources, technical assistance, et cetera. But we do have the ability to have fines for, and that tends to be like for repeat violations, et cetera.
Vice Chair Garcia.
Yes. Again, thank you so much for coming to this meeting. We really appreciate the direct input, and I'd like to ask that people that are attending do attend these webinars, sign up for the email list. I've attended a couple of the webinars, and it's been very helpful, and a lot of this information has been shared, so it helps get us kind of all on the same page. I just wanted a couple points of clarification on formaldehyde. We have until December of 27. Is that correct to come in compliance?
So the rule is what's going to change formaldehyde releasers. Formaldehyde already is restricted as of January 1st of 2025, formaldehyde and methylene glycol. Those two chemicals, so the sell-through period ends at the end of 2025. So by January 1st of 2026, no products can contain formaldehyde or methylene glycol. The rest of the formaldehyde releasers, assuming that the rule is adopted, will be restricted January 1st of 2027 with a one-year sell-through period to the end of 2027. So January 1st of 2028, all products will not have formaldehyde releasers.
Very good. Thank you for that. And when it comes to the phenylene diamines, we're not to that point yet. Is that correct?
Ethylene diamines are restricted. Two of them are already restricted. They're primarily found in hair dyes. And to be honest with you, they're not used very frequently. There's a third phenylene diamine called paraphenylene diamine that's not restricted in this law. That's the one that's most commonly used in hair dyes today. So we are tracking that. We're looking for safer alternatives to that, the paraphenylene diamine, but the two that have been restricted are meta and ortho. And yes, so that restriction already went into effect and the sell-through period ends at the end of this year. So any manufacturers that were using it should be having that reformulated by the end of, actually they should already have reformulated, before January 1st of 2025.
Okay. Most permanent hair color is using paraffin.
Correct.
Thank you. That helps a lot. And I have noticed in some of the supply houses that are some new brands that don't have any phenylene diamines in them at all, which I haven't tried any, but that'll be interesting to try.
That's what we're hoping is going to happen, is that things keep moving towards safer alternatives. So part of the voluntary initiatives that we have funding to identify and assess chemicals that serve the same function as the restricted chemicals and make that information publicly available to support manufacturers in their reformulation. So that is part of this law as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. And Board Member Martin again.
Just really quick, I mean, out of curiosity, what's the level of cooperation between the Department of Ecology and the manufacturers been? Like, has it been received well? Is there pushback? Like, what is the consensus from that side of it?
Yeah, excellent question. The biggest pushback we have received is around the lead impurities. That's the one that they're most concerned about. The places that we're far out ahead, we're ahead of all other states, we're ahead of all other countries. Lead is the big one where we're ahead of everyone in the world. We're the most restrictive. So that's significant. So that's where you'll feel the whole industry push back, because the industry is a global industry. They're formulating products for the whole world. So if some other country has already restricted something or done something more conservative, they're like, whatever. So it's where we're asking them to really move that we get the pushback. The other is the formaldehyde releasers, that rule. And we have had some, you know, with our public comments, you'll see if they're all published on our website. So you can look at what the industry associations are asking us to do, but there is pushback in that space as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chair True. You're still muted.
I'm not sure if you've touched on this, but what other states have implemented these things too?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know off the top of my head all of them, but what I can say is California was the first start restricting chemicals in cosmetic products. They were out at the front, which they typically are. Our law came in about the same time as a few other states, Oregon, Washington, and then there's a couple on the East Coast. And I think there's like Vermont, Minnesota. I know there's a few other states, and I'm going to get them wrong because I'm talking off the top of my head, but there's a handful of states that are sort of leading in the toxics and products laws, including laws on cosmetics. The place where California is really leading is in transparency. So they've got a series of laws that require manufacturers to either put all their ingredients into a database or publish their ingredients on products. So they're really leading in that space, which is really significant for professional products because, as you probably are all aware, while consumer products have to have every ingredient on the label per the FDA requirements, professional products don't have that same requirement. So it's a lot harder for us as a regulatory agency and you as people purchasing those products to know what's in there and avoid problematic chemicals. So the state of California did pass a law requiring manufacturers of professional products to submit the ingredients of those products into their database. So that's something that is moving in that space as well. So there's transparency laws and then there's bans. So you'll see a little bit of both of those things.